141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our discussion about the legal case that that Abraham Lincoln worked for or worked in to free an American slave. My guests are Carl Adams. He is author of the book Nance: Trials of the First Slave Freed by Abraham Lincoln, and Dr. Greg Carr, chair of the Afro-American Studies Department at Howard University. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. If you want information about this book, you can find it at nancebook.com. That's N-A-N-C-E book.com. And as always, of course, we will be posting that information on our website, whur.com, after the program. Before I get back to the story, let me go to Joe. Joe calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Joe. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I just have kind of a common question, and it's every time I hear this topic brought up about Africans, African descendants who were enslaved, it makes my skin crawl to hear our ancestors and hear people refer to as slaves, as objects. And so the two gentlemen who are there who are teachers, educators about slavery, about this specific topic, if you could please, in the audiences that you reach, please stop referring to our ancestors or Africans or African descendants who were enslaved as the object slaves. Let's make sure that we're driving the point home to the audiences that you reach and the audiences that you teach that these were people. And we have to really begin to humanize, and we don't do that. We don't do service to our ancestors.
Let me stop you there, Joe.
I agree with him. In fact, Joe, I agree. In fact, you didn't hear me say that, and you will never hear me say that as an educator. I fully agree with you. You can't put that label on. But I guess it is a tough one, though.
Yeah, I don't think it's tough at all. I don't think it's tough at all because we need not to forgive the term whitewash the history that is going on in this country. Because certainly, Joe, let me say that there have been discussions over the past several years about textbooks talking about slaves, and they were slaves. They were taken from their homeland. They were brought here. They didn't just work for free. They worked under horrible conditions. It was slavery. So there's no other way to put it. It may be, and it's supposed to make your skin crawl, because that is the very nature of our history. And so I completely disagree with you. And I don't think that, as we have seen in some history books, which have tried to change the definition of slavery in this country and to call them workers. Yes, they worked themselves to death. So that's all I got to say about that, Jeff. Let me take the next call. Mark, let's go to Virginia. What's on your mind, Mark?
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question. The guy who wrote the book, my question is, in his research and writing the book, did he find out any descendants of the lady that was freed, and are they currently living in the D.C. area?
Not in the D.C. area. I did find there were some descendants, however, during the Woodrow Wilson administration, a chapter of the Ku Klux took over the county offices and city offices and obliterated the records.
Wow.
They also took pride on claiming that Tazewell County was 99.9% white.
Hmm.
And so basically any person they objected to, regardless, and some of them included Native Americans, were basically persuaded to leave one way or another. And in fact, it became known as a sundown town, in which that they had a sign at the railroad depot and at the riverboat landing saying that if a black man is a black man will not see the sunset in this town, and they did not use polite terminology.
Mm-hmm.
And in my work, I have been called everything in the book from a racist to a Negro lover, and they did not use polite terminology when they spoke to me about that either.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your phone call.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Carl, let's talk about how this issue got to court. I don't want to get too far afield.
Mm-hmm. How it got to court. Okay. Mm-hmm. How it got to court was her master, Colonel Thomas Cox, was a hardcore whiskey addict, and he owned his own commercial-grade distillery, and he drank too much of it. And he was also a director of the Illinois State Bank, and started messing with the funds.
Mm.
He was an official of the Federal Land Office, and he was fired by Congress for official misconduct. By this time, he had built a large empire, a one-man's empire, four businesses and multiple buildings in the newer capital, Springfield, Illinois. And this was before it became capital. So what had happened was he had borrowed so much money, and now his creditors come back to haunt him. The Illinois State Bank went under. He borrowed $300 from the richest man in the county, Nathaniel Cromwell Jr., and then, still intoxicated, he turned around and borrowed another $500 from the county sheriff. Now it's, and didn't pay him back. Now, it's pretty clear you don't borrow money from the senior law enforcement officer in the county and then not pay him back without there being trouble. Now, he had mortgaged Nance and her younger sister, Dicey, to Sheriff Taylor, and then turned around 9 months later, mortgaged the same two servants as well as his home, his marriage bed, and his ox mill, and his distillery, and mortgaged them to Nathaniel Cromwell using the same collateral for both loans.
Wow.
And then he went under.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they went to call collect on him, he didn't have it. And so the judge at the time, John York Sawyer, passed a signed whatever paperwork he had to do. He said, okay, foreclose on him and seize his property. So they seized the slaves first, Nance and younger sister Dicey. Dicey was only about 10.
And how old was Nance?
The punch of all that was Nance was just 13 and a half years old when she was beaten up and locked in solitary confinement for at least 6 days.
Okay.
And so she was treated very harshly, not by her master, but by the county coroner, who I traced his genealogy and his history through Illinois. He was an Indian fighter during the War of 1812. He was the kind of man who may have had Indian scalps on his horse. And
so why did he beat her?
He beat her just because he could.
Okay.
There was no reason for it. I mean, she was a teenage girl. And there was no reason to beat her except for the fact that somebody let her out of solitary confinement. Mm-hmm. Nance couldn't let herself out. Somebody else let her out.
So you said that at this point, the property, including the slaves, was confiscated.
Yes.
Okay.
And seized and auctioned.
Mm-hmm.
And now Dicey was 10 years old, probably intimidated, probably crying. She went with Sheriff Taylor, and that was the last heard of her. Nance protested and protested and refused and said, I ain't going to do it. And she was probably feeling protective of her younger sister because their older brother Reuben wasn't around. He was in a different part of the county. So she was trying to protect not only herself, but her younger sister Dicey, and fought back. And then, according to the lawsuit, John Howard assaulted her no less than four times. And I had to edit this out of the book because it was a little bit too graphic.
Because this book is really for young teens.
It is intended for teenagers.
Right, yes, but the story certainly much more involved. Yeah. So please go ahead.
Yeah, now some of the violence was edited, the most graphic part. Now, this is an adult radio program. So
yeah, sure.
Basically, he ripped chunks of hair off of her head.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was the kind of thing that maybe an Indian scalper would do, ripping chunks of hair off of her head. It was enough to make her scalp bleed. And she was described as black in all descriptions. So, therefore, she probably had white patches of skin on her face and skull that were visible to Lincoln. And Lincoln had been clubbed on the head by slaves when he was 19 years old. And he showed the scars on his head to a fellow lawyer 21 years afterwards in 1849. So there, that was the bond, the scars.
The book is titled Trials of the First Slave Freed by Abraham Lincoln. This just wasn't a one and done.
Oh, no. She was the only African-American known of any state to manage to get her case heard by a state Supreme Court three times.
Mm-hmm.
She was denied her personal liberty by the courts four times.
So what was Lincoln's argument? You've done a very good job at setting, the scene. And we are talking about more than two decades before the Civil War. This isn't 1960. Okay, you know, this is a very, very hostile environment for black people who have absolutely nothing. How was Lincoln able to argue these three times to get to ultimately win this victory?
Yeah, well, Dr. Carr, the walking encyclopedia here, he cut right through it, and he went right to the chase, and he picked out what was that Lincoln's leading argument was. Lincoln used no less than three times in court three different references that said, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist in the territory nor the state of Illinois. And he used that same argument 25 years later for the 13th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist. And he referenced that from the Northwest Ordinance of July 13, 1787. He referenced that no less than three times in the courts. Now, I asked a Supreme Court lawyer, why would he be redundant and say it three times? He says, well, Supreme Court justices tend to be old and sometimes they fall asleep on the bench. He said, so if they didn't get it the first time, hit it with them again. And if they may have still been sleeping, hit it with them again. And so he did. Now, the one thing about the justice that Lincoln was arguing to was Sidney Breese, and he was a politician too. And he said, very well, lawyers, you may present your case, but you cannot give any speeches. Hmm. However, Lincoln had a gift of gab, and he used three totally different references that all said the same thing, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist. However, his last reference was from English common law dating as far back as 1702 from the King's Chief Justice Holt. It was the same trial where a poet or a lawyer said, slaves cannot breathe in England. The air is too pure. As soon as they hear, their shackles fall off. Well, I can imagine what Lincoln might have done with that. I mean, if old grandmother England's air was too pure, you can imagine the new state of Illinois, our air is even more pure. It shouldn't be here at all.
You know what I'm hearing, Dr. Carr, in this story? This argument was not an argument about morality. This was a law and order moment. This was a legal maneuver.
Of course. What you have is a spreading country, and it's very true. When you hear Brother Adams talk about the Northwest Ordinance, 1787, slavery is very profitable in the South, and it's really one of the dynamic engines of American progress. But as they move across the continent, they've got to figure out how to contain it, how to manage it. And so the Northwest Ordinance, it allows enslavement to spread in certain places, but it restricts it other places. By the time you get to the Missouri Compromise and then to the Great Compromise of 1850, they're trying to contain enslavement, but the legal fictions that are constructed are happening in the wake of trying to constrain it. So, yes, you could actually have slaves. You could have enslaved people in Illinois, but you couldn't call them enslaved people. Right. The legal fiction, and he does a brilliant job, I think, Ms. Adams, in his book and in his scholarship, of revealing that it says indentured servitude, but in a court of law, isn't that the same thing? So when Lincoln is making this legal argument, he's basically, I mean, well, let me not get too far ahead of us. Mm. When you trace, again, how she asserts her humanity by refusing to sign this contract, then, you know, you're talking about there are protections for indentured servants. Mm-hmm. So when she says she is not going to sign, I mean, a good lawyer looks at that and says, well, wait a minute. Now we have a question of her humanity that's at stake, because you're saying technically if they don't sign a contract, they can't. And first they say, well, she's awarded to court. She's too young. But finally, I'll say this, and this is why Dred Scott becomes important later. Later on, Justice Taney of the Supreme Court erases all of this by saying that black people were never meant to be citizens in the first place. So forget the distinction between state law and federal law. There's no place in this country that black people have any rights that anyone is bound to respect, because they were never included in the contract to begin with.
And including a courtroom.
That's exactly right, which is what then, of course, sets off the Civil War. At that point, now you got to settle it on the battlefield. But as a lawyer, Lincoln understands full well the meaning of this, and he's testing the limits of this law.
I need to take another break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Russell, calling from Frederick, Maryland. So stay with us, Russell. Fascinating discussion about a little-known piece of black history that is before today in this book, Nance, Trials of the First Slave Freed by Abraham Lincoln. We'll be talking about it more after the break. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continued the discussion about the legal case that involved Abraham Lincoln and the first slave that he freed in a courtroom. Let's go back to the phone lines real quick. Racelle calling from Frederick. Racelle, thanks for calling. Thanks for hanging on. What's on your mind?
Sure. Good evening. I'm a native Washingtonian, and I have lived in Frederick since 2003. And I listened to the broadcast this evening, and I was wondering, he mentioned a gentleman by the name of Roger Taney.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So I lived on Taney Avenue for several years. It was about at least for 10 or 11 years here in Frederick. I moved here from Washington, D.C., because I was going through a divorce. And also, I am affiliated with Howard University quite a bit. I was at the Howard University Hospital for about 12 years.
So, Racelle, tell me what your question is, please.
Oh, okay. When I moved, sir, and again, I moved to Taney Avenue in Frederick, and I was wondering, is that the person with, you know, that street was named after?
Yes, probably.
Did he own slaves at one time? Because this is what I'm hearing here in Frederick, and I would like to know a little bit more about that gentleman.
Yes, he did. Roger Taney was the fifth Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He did come from a family who owned in, who had Africans enslaved in Calvert County, Maryland. It probably was named for his family, but he did manumit the Africans, ironically, in his direct, he did manumit them. They were freed in his family, although he wrote the most famous pro-slavery Supreme Court decision in American history, and that is the Dred Scott versus Stanford case. But probably so. There are a lot of tiny avenues, not just in Maryland, but in Virginia. But yeah, he's a native Marylander. His statue is still on the State House grounds in Annapolis, Maryland, if I'm not mistaken.
However, and if you, how far are you from City Hall in Frederick?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, probably about 8 to 10 minutes.
Okay, next time you go by there, look for the spot where his statue used to be.
You did that story, didn't you, Harold?
We talked about that, you know, here in the newscast last year.
That's right.
After, you know, a lot of back and forth because of the history, his statue was removed from the City Hall grounds because of his not only his ownership of slavery, but his opposition to his pro-slavery attitude. So certainly, you know, it is interesting that you should indeed ask about it, and you are, you know, more on point than you know about, you know, learning about this kind of information. So thank you so much, Racelle, for hanging on and asking that question.
You could always petition to change the name of the street to Nance Avenue.
Yeah, there. How about that? Yeah.
Actually, I'm a little interested in all of this because just several days ago, I was racially profiled in one of the stores here in Frederick, where actually it was near Walkersville.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was the first time that I had really pretty much experienced that.
Mm-hmm.
So I really had some feelings about it. And then when I tried to get help and I called down to the court, they sent me around the city and I was running around like a chicken with my head cut.
Well, certainly that kind of thing will definitely give you pause. And again, I want to thank you so much for sharing with us, and hopefully it'll, you know, prompt you to, you know, to take a look at yourself. You just never know what you may dig up. But Racelle, thank you so much for sharing with us. Carl, how did this story come to a head and indeed an end? And how long did this take?
Well, it was the longest Supreme Court appeal up to that time in Illinois history. It went on from 1836 to 1841. And Lincoln didn't. It took him 2 years to sort through the Cromwell estate because it was so vast. Like I said, he was the richest man in three counties. And then Bailey lost his first case in Cromwell versus Bailey in 1838. Went to trial. Then it was continued to 1839. And then Bailey lost, and that was when he considered appealing to the Supreme Court. And so that was when he asked his old war buddy, Lincoln, to take the case in late 1839. And so Lincoln knew Nance. He knew Bailey. He knew all the participants for years before he ever got the case. But what had happened was that then it had to go to the Supreme Court. And as I put in the book, to add to the moral weight of a slavery case, they finally tried the Supreme Court hearing in a church. The Capitol building was not yet finished. And so they had to hold a 3-week Supreme Court session in July of 1841 in St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Springfield, Illinois. And that was where the verdict came down. And I would imagine that a little help from the Almighty was probably Lincoln crossing his fingers going, okay, now do your stuff. And so I still believe that there may be an element of providence in this, just because I was able to find Nance's family when everybody thought that would be impossible.
And you did.
Yes.
And what was that like?
Oh, God, it was very, very difficult. It was genealogy. And basically, you know, how do you find a black person when you don't know where they're from and you don't know their last name and you don't know their family? How do you find them? Well, you trace the white families. Now, one of the helps that I had was that a cousin from New York had finished my family's genealogy, and I had read it. And in there, they found proof that I was a distant cousin of John Quincy Adams, because at the same time, he was arguing for the Amistad slaves in 1841 in Washington. My great-great-grandfather was conductor of the Underground Railroad where the Illinois and Mississippi rivers came together in Illinois. And so he was the third cousin of John Quincy Adams.
So when you talked to the Nance family, what was their reaction when you began to share with them what you had found?
I haven't found them yet.
You haven't found them?
I haven't found them.
Oh, I see. I thought you had.
No, this was tracing genealogy backwards. But what had happened was the later, because it was taken over by the Klan in 100 years ago, and they were pushed out, I lost track of them. Mm-hmm. I've tried to find them. I did find one, and I sent a letter, and I got return to sender, no forwarding address. I did find Nance's son's grave in, of all places, Rochester, Minnesota. And
Wow.
So, I mean, the family is scattered, and I did do a computer search. There are only like 3,000 to 5,000 families all in the United States that have the last name of Leggins or Costly. But they were illiterate. They didn't know how to read and write.
Yeah.
And I found 12 different spellings for William Henry Costley's last name. Costley, Corsley, Coosley, mm-hmm. you name it. Mm-hmm. But so that's, you have to rely on Soundex, which is just basically the CLSY, and put those together and so go on Soundex and just come up with an approximation.
Dr. Carr, this is such a fascinating story, and even in this conversation, we're only scratching the surface. But you know, to that point, you know, other than, you know, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Frederick Douglass, Lincoln freed the slaves, Mayflower, whatever, why is it that we don't know these kinds of hyper important stories as African Americans in this country?
Because American history is irreconcilable, in my opinion. I would say the American state is a settler state. Genocide against millions of Native Americans, the forced abduction of millions of Africans, poor whites coming here with a promise of one thing, bait and switch, get here and find out it's totally different. Anytime you look backward in American history with the idea that somehow you can make this into a beautiful story, it's not going to work. So that's why we don't learn it in school. But unfortunately, what's the irony in that? The other side is, if we don't learn it, then looking forward in American history, we will continue to keep making the same kind of errors. And so, you know, if we don't understand the story of Nance, a woman, a human being, a child at first, who stands for herself, and then we don't understand Abraham Lincoln, one of the most complex figures in American history, at a moment standing for this human being at an early part of a career that will take him on every side of this issue, then what we refuse to do finally is look at our own humanity. You know, we're not talking about heroes or villains. We're talking about human beings trying to figure out how to be in the world. And that's what the study of history should all allow us to do, find our own humanity. The reason we don't study this is, I think, in part because of the fear that somehow if we just, you know, forget about it, we can somehow get over it. Well, getting over it requires, like any other trauma, facing the thing.
Sure.
Carl, what happened to Nance?
Oh, she lived a long and healthy life. She was a good neighbor. She did not object to being of service to anyone so long as she was not considered a slave. It said she participated in all festival occasions. She suffered and celebrated with her community through three wars and three disease epidemics. And that is where I think Nance won over her neighbors. She lived in a community that was 95% white, and as she approached old age, everybody loved her, and they respected her family. And she was the legend was that she was frequently sought after for advice, that she was of service in all festival occasions. And the first festival occasion was 2 years after her emancipation in 1843, when Lincoln held the state Whig convention in her hometown.
Do you have evidence of you know, how she died, when she died?
Not evidence of how she died, approximately 1873, but there's no death record. Now, she did presumably die with surrounded by her family. She lived in a wooded area that was surrounded by three bodies of water, and she lived on the only road that Lincoln could use to travel north, which meant that Lincoln could watch her children grow up over the years. And so when Lincoln was in D.C. and all those people said, you cannot emancipate these people because disastrous things are going to happen, he already could see for himself that that did not happen with Nance's family. Hmm. He watched her eight children grow up and they were fine. Yeah. They got along just fine.
Carl Adams' book is Nance, Trials of the First Slave Freed by Abraham Lincoln. Of course, you can find out more about it at nancebook.com. That's NANCEbook.com. And I can't wait for the movie. I'm going to claim that for you. I think it's just a fantastic story. And as always, Dr. Greg Carr, it's always a pleasure to have you here.
Always
Thank
good
you so
to be
much.
With you, Brother Harold.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Tuesday, February 21st. I'm Harold Fisher. You can follow me on Twitter at HFisher, WHUR, or at Daily Drum, WHUR.